Hello from the East Coast to the West Coast and to listeners around the world. Welcome to the Truth Seekers Radio Show. I'm your host, Angeline Marie. Thanks for taking the time to join us today. My guest is Tom Donahue. Tom is a radio talk show host and has also been a program director for TalkStream Live since 2013. He's an investigative broadcaster whose mission is to seek truth, promote liberty, and defend freedom. He's a politically independent constitutionalist and Jeffersonian libertarian. His work has aired on syndicated affiliates that include KCAA Radio, Red State Talk Radio, Orion Talk Radio, TSL Talks, and many others. In the 1990s, Tom hosted America's Town Forum, his nationally syndicated show that broadcast via Talk America Radio Network, People's Radio Network, and Sun Radio Networks. Later, Tom was selected for national syndication to replace Chuck Harder at the Sun Radio Network weekday afternoons based in Clearwater, Florida. He ultimately joined Chuck Harder's new network, the People's Radio Network, for mid-mornings, and eventually landed with the Talk America Radio Network in Boston, Massachusetts. Tom's also been recognized for his broadcast achievements as a radio talk show host by Talkers the Frontier 50 and TalkStream Live the Power 50. And if you will help me welcome my good friend and colleague, Tom Donahue. How are you doing today, Tom?
Angeline, great. Thanks for the warm welcome and all the accolades, and I appreciate that. And I do have a storied history, some of it controversial, some of it right on target, or at least targeting the bad guys as it relates to politics and the media.
Well, Tom, for those of us that really don't know how you got your start, why don't we begin there? How did you get the talk radio bug, and then how did that coincide with your work in the liberty movement?
Well, it's actually a peculiar pathway. I majored in communications, human and mass communications at Rutgers University. But my interest at that time was not broadcasting. It wasn't journalism. It was more about the human side and relating to how people communicate through in organizations and in business and various other things. I really didn't believe that I'd be entering the broadcast field in a direct way, meaning on air. What took me eventually, I was listening to talk radio, some of it late night with Larry King, some of it in the local marketplace in Philadelphia, and there was a talk show host, now icon, legend, deceased, Irv Homer. And he was taking on the IRS in his broadcast, and he was City Hall and a lot of local stuff, but also national. When I heard him interview Irwin Schiff as it related to the income tax issues and the Social Security swindle, it caught fire. I mean, it lit the torch of liberty within myself, and I didn't expect that. So I went out and bought the book and started to study in these issues and these areas. And then eventually I ended up in the publishing field in marketing, and I did a relocation to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and covered a four-state territory. And at that time, I was introduced to people, in the strangest ways. I think it was just meant to be. Some of them were John Bergers. Some of them were just America Firsters, tax patriots. And I started just gobbling up the material. And the first book beyond the tax protest issues or tax freedom and constitutional issues was None Dare Call It a Conspiracy by Gary Allen. And that book, I mean, I was very interested and very engaged. And I started hearkening back and I said, wait a minute, my political science class at Rutgers, we had six books in this particular course, but one of them happened to be C. Wright Mills, The Power Elite. And he was talking about this elite that came from politics, the military, banking, the media. And so it all started to tie together for me. Really, it was the patriot side as it related to taxes and challenging the unconstitutionality of our taxes and Social Security system and forced socialism upon the American populace. And the other really was the conspiratorial side, that things don't happen accidentally and randomly, but it's by design plan. So that's kind of how it all started. I can tell you a little more about the media mechanics and how I got into it as well.
Okay, so in the 90s, you start America's Town Forum. Can you tell us how that started?
Well, really, when I was in Oklahoma, eventually I decided to move on from publishing and working for a company to being self-employed, working for myself, independent type contractor. And I was influenced by an organization in Tulsa called the Freeman Association. And so this Freeman Association Education Association. I decided to form the American Liberty Association in Dallas, Texas. I relocated and worked alongside with them. And there was the NCBA out of Denver that really helped create this warehouse, free exchange, First Amendment type political associations, and also dealt with gold and silver and our economics as it related to sound money. I had this knack. I said, well, why aren't there bigger meetings? Why are these meetings like in diners and Denny's and, why can't we get the people out? And I said, well, maybe we could bring these type of speakers to the radio airwaves. And I had this uncanny ability and maybe a little bit of luck as well as a knack for being able to work behind the scenes to organize, and not like Obama, because I actually got things done and I actually was working, but I was able to bring these various, authors, people that were in the Freedom Patriot constitutional movement to the airwaves that most people, the general populace, never heard. Whether it was Pastor Everett Sullivan or former Congressman George Hansen or Eustace Mullins on Secrets of the Federal Reserve and the World Order. And they were the most popular guests that these radio stations, even news stations, had. And so then we were doing TV bookings where they did interview type shows. And what happened was it went from me doing the solicitation to them sending the invites and inquiries as to, well, when is your next rally? When's the next meeting? When are you having more guests come into town? And it was around that time that it dawned on me that we got to take this message coast to coast and border to border. And everybody was telling me it's impossible. It can't be done. Everything is controlled. And I said, well, the worst that's going to happen is they're going to say no. And I kept getting more yeses. And it started to spiral into a really good positive force. And so I started having these dreams, and I really felt led by the Spirit, and I'll say the Holy Spirit, and if it offends someone, so be it. Well, actually, let me step back a moment. There was the Dallas Morning News took a great interest in what we were doing. They started seeing these big meeting halls and rallies and auditoriums and even in churches, and they took notice. And so there was a glossy section of the Dallas Morning News, which still exists, called the Dallas Life Magazine, similar to like New York Times and other big publications on Sundays. They'll have a detailed spread on a particular subject or guest or whatever. They selected myself and my organization, the American Liberty Association, as the group that most modeled the founding fathers, the precepts and the foundational principles. So the precepts and principles, they said, would go well with the bicentennial celebration of the Constitution back in 1987. And so this was published on September 20th, even though the date for Constitution Day and the bicentennial, the date each year is always September the 17th. It was a great honor. And they gave us a pretty positive presentation. There were some things that, of course, the writer's going to be, some biases came out and there was some things that were a little twisted. But overall, I mentioned this in a recent interview that came back to me because Debbie Fisher's passing and also her daughter. And so within a 24-hour period. So Todd Fisher, the son of, read this. I guess he picked up the Dallas Morning News in Los Angeles and said, I've been involved in all this conspiracy stuff. It fascinates me. And is there any way I can talk to Eustace Mullins? And I set that up. And so Eustace Mullins actually flew out to Los Angeles. I don't think that the film project ever got off the ground, but at least there was great interest. So I was getting calls from various Patriot leaders and various other organizations saying, how are you doing this in Dallas? And I would explain to them that, how I approached them and, how I wrote the press releases and various things. So I said, okay. I was asked to be a guest on shows, which I thought maybe I picked up some things through, osmosis being in and out of these studios, but I still didn't think that I had all that much to say. And I didn't think that I was really all that well equipped. I wasn't an author and, I was basically an organizer, and I was someone that was educating to some degree, making books and tapes available and whatnot. And so people thought I was a natural. That really took off. So I said, calling for me was that I had to go on the air. I had to figure out a way that I could break into the talk radio racket. It wasn't easy, and I was willing to go anywhere to get the experience. So we did some brokered time on the weekends, and that took off well. And that gave me the demo tapes to send out, to the various markets. And I had two offers that were pending. One was in Las Vegas and the other was in Idaho Falls, Idaho. And I knew that Idaho was, you know, very much conservative, constitutionally based. I knew that there were the groups in Montana and Idaho, and I figured it would be very popular, and I really didn't want to be around a gambling environment. So I took the offer. It wasn't a whole lot of money, but they also gave me an opportunity to sell and help them market, and it was an instant success. So it was funny. I still had that America's Town Forum as the name, or America First. The real interesting thing was that I started taking some heat from the conservative side because I was against, you know, Papa Bush and his New World Order's, you know, Middle East excursions and demolition derby. And so the Republican Party said, well, we got to back, you know, George Bush, the senior, George Herbert Walker Bush. And I said, oh, I'm not doing that. And I'm not backing him or Cheney. And Cheney at that time was the defense secretary. So I was, there was some heat put on me, but the general manager said, your show's popular. You know, you do offer alternate points of view. You know, you're generally pretty conservative guy, just independent. So he did not fire me. He did not, which was a call for that because I wouldn't support the war, even though I supported the troops, you know, in terms of, you know, hoping that, you know, that they could stay out of harm's way and get home as safe and as soon as possible. But so my general manager, he walked in at one point. Oh, well, I know this was kind of interesting. He said, well, you should be able to produce your own show, because I wasn't a technical person. I'm still not that great at technical stuff, but I've learned a lot of things. And I said, well, what do you pay for the producer? I have bigger goals than this. I don't care about working a board and all that. So he told me what she would need to be paid for those 3 hours. So I took it out of my own pay. And I said, I just need to stay focused on content, on interviews, on research, on delivery of the message. And that's what I did. So, I actually took a paid demotion, subsidized my on-air producer for that. And, it was worth it because I didn't want to be distracted. I wanted to be able to stay focused on my mission and my purpose. And I was able to. So about another month or two later, my general manager comes in and says, by the way, he said, Chuck Carter is leaving the Sun Radio Network that he founded. And they're not sure what they're going to do. He said, who knows? Maybe they'd hire you. Well, I went into the next room. My show was already complete. I called down to the Sun Radio Network. I asked him how I can send demo tapes. And so he goes, you've sold yourself well. He said, I think we're going to go with this big personality out of New York, but, you know, we'll review your tapes. So this is on a Wednesday. So, you know, I called to make sure they received them. They said, yeah. So I get a call at 7 in the morning. Well, at that time, that was mountain time. And I'm thinking, who's calling me at 7 in the morning? I'm not an early riser. You know, my show was in the afternoons. And they said, this is Carl, from Sun Radio Network. I've been up all night listening to your tapes. I said, well, listen to my tapes? He said, yeah. He said, we think that you would be the best person that the audience would accept in replacing Chuck Carter and also competing with Chuck Carter. He said, but we can't guarantee anything. Maybe you could hold that job and do a 30-day trial. I said, well, we're not going to do it that way. I said, if it's 30-day trial, I'll just take the risk and relocate and I will accept your offer. And that's what happened. And it was the biggest news. Everyone thought it was a joke. I walk into the studios. I said, I'm going to be receiving a faxed offer from Sun Radio Network and I don't have a fax machine. Yeah. And they were all laughing. And it was really mm-hmm. huge news. It actually was on the TV news and all that. And so it was a really, I just stayed focused. My dreams were, this message had to go border to border and coast to coast, that we had to win back our country, that we had to fight the forces of evil. And I never gave up on this vision. You know, I mean, I was being considered for major market positions as well. If my general manager hadn't come out and just kind of jabbed me a little bit. I mean, he was saying it more kind of jokingly, even though he knew I had talent. And I ended up replacing Chuck Carter. I mean, it was just a huge day. And the day that I replaced him was April 1st, you know, be befitting April Fool's, 1991. And so that was the day that I launched into national syndication and just barely got there. I got into Tampa like 4 a.m. and I was to go on the air at 2 p.m. And so I only got a couple hours sleep. And then I didn't even know where the studios were. I'd never been to Clearwater. So it was just a great time. It was very exciting. And you know, there was no internet back then. There was no, I mean, people relied on either talk radio, real talk radio through broadcast airwaves stations, or, and there was no podcast. So you could get an audio cassette, you know, delayed, you know, mailed to you. And so it was the technology. It was, you know, the vehicle to reach the American populace and try to wake them up, you know, beyond magazines and beyond meetings.
So would you say you were one of the pioneers of what we know today as alternative media?
I think so, because Alex Jones was still in school at the time, and he hadn't even gotten to, you know, the public access TV yet in Dallas, Texas, and then later Austin. So, you know, many people do give a tremendous amount of credit to me because I was in broadcast radio, and, you know, and I talked about the word, the C word, that a lot of people, even Chuck Carter, would try to kind of dodge that word some and try to, you know, he tried to, you know, make it more palatable. And I didn't worry about it being palatable. You know, I used a sledgehammer. He used the velvet glove. And so.
Right. Because he was mostly consumer issues, if I remember. Of course, back in 91, I don't think I was listening to him yet. And you say you were more on conspiracy.
Yeah. He tilted a little more left, but he was alternative. I tilted more right. We were both to some degree independent, but I, you know, I would have never had a guest on like, Ralph Nader, and I would have never been a fan of Ross Perot, even though I interviewed Ross Perot. Chuck Carter and, the For the People Network, they got fully behind Perot, and then, and they were really, you know, so they were, like I say, I was a staunch constitutionalist and I was a social conservative, but I was very independent thinker and I had some libertarian leanings. And so it, you know, so we agreed on a lot of things. And what I did was when I brought speakers to, Jacksonville, Florida, well, what happened, and this is just, you know, kind of interesting too, was, I was competing against him. So we were like splitting stations, you know, and I was doing pretty well against the giant in the industry. And I didn't see him as an enemy, but they kind of did because, you know, I was actually holding my own. They just thought they would take all the stations from whomever was the replacement. They were very strategic. There were some issues with that network. You know, Chuck helped create some of the financial, problems that network had, and he started over. And so did they. They really were radio people that were trying to run it. And so I knew that it wasn't going to last that long, the Sun Radio Network. And so Chuck had his general manager that was still in the Tampa Bay area, even though Chuck was, you know, relocated to White Springs, in the hinterland of, in North Florida, very close to the Georgia border. And so they said, well, he called me into a meeting. They said, we'd like to offer you the morning position. It, you know, we know that the financial difficulties, the network's not going to last. And we know that, you know, you would bring a lot of audience and you and Chuck would not be directly competing. So we kind of joined forces. And so they said, you could live in the Telford Hotel and broadcast in Studio B. And so I did, but it was desolate. You know, it was, I mean, a single guy in the middle of nowhere and not even grocery stores close by. Eventually, I said, you know, I gotta find a place where, there's humanity, you know, and that I can have social interaction. I can't just do all, broadcast radio. So I relocated to Jacksonville and also secured a 50,000 watt station as my flagship. So things started falling into place and I started meeting more people and the show continued to grow in popularity. And I almost went with the title of America First. Matter of fact, I set up a DBA. And any checks that came in for books, tapes, I really wasn't a nonprofit, so I didn't really seek out donations per se, came in the name of America First. On my card, I had America First on it as the organization. But I thought, and I was advised that if I called the show America First, they might confuse it with the 1940s America First. There might be some negative connotations. So I said, you know what? Who could argue with America's Town Forum? But it's still going to have the America First theme. You know, I was still going to consider myself to be a constitutionalist, but also a populist and a protectionist. And I was proudly so.
Well, speaking of populist, and you say you've always kind of gone against the grain. I mean, you've always kind of done what you wanted to do. Like you said, back in the Bush administration, the conservatives would get on you because you weren't necessarily backing the Bush. So what do you think about Trump and why do you think he's resonated so much with the people in this last presidential election?
Well, back in the 1992 political election cycle, I did interview Jerry Brown, Pat Buchanan. I interviewed representatives, you know, some of the higher ups for Clinton and Bush. You know, I didn't interview either of those, but because I had a national platform, I was able to get top shelf guests. Many times I wasn't interested in most of them, but because it was a political season, I was fortunate enough. I had Ross Perot for, I think, 45 minutes to an hour. Back then, I also interviewed Pat Robertson, although he was a candidate back in 1988. It was really an interesting time. And I really was a fan, and I still have a great appreciation. I don't agree with everything that Pat Buchanan has said or written, but he was the one that talked about America First during his campaign. He talked about dethroning King George, and he did win the New Hampshire primary. And so I remember this very clearly, very distinctly. On CNN, the chairman for the Republican Party came on and said, "We will not allow... We will do all that we have to do to stop Buchanan from being our nominee." It wasn't a matter about the people voting. I mean, he had just won the New Hampshire primary, almost won the Iowa caucus. He was heading into South Carolina with a lot of momentum, but they derailed him. They did everything they could to destroy Pat Buchanan. And I don't think Pat Buchanan gets enough credit for that particular political run, you know, going against a seated incumbent president of your party is a very difficult task. And it's not like just starting out. I mean, Trump did have to compete with 17 others, and that was, quite a challenge, a battle royale, if you will. I think that I would have liked to have seen Trump give some more credit to, in particular, Pat Buchanan, even Ross Perot to some extent. You know, they were talking about trade issues, and they were talking about fighting NAFTA and GATT. So there was this America First movement that was going on in the 90s, not just the 1940s, you know, and trying to keep us out of foreign entanglements and some of the wars in Europe and, you know, the Pacific. But it almost seems like history has escaped a lot of people, and people seem to, and even Pat Buchanan has been very humble, to not say, hey, basically, you stole my playbook, because that's really what it was. I mean, Pat Buchanan and then Ross Perot, to some extent, were fighting these issues. And so not as much, you know, they were similar, you know. And but in terms of trade, you know, you had strange bedfellows from the left and the right, including myself, Chuck Carter, you know, Ralph Nader, Jerry Brown. It was really peculiar to see how many people, you know, were joining forces to fight this so-called free trade, which is not fair trade, and it's just, you know, enriching the global, you know, the coffers of the global elite. And that's really what we're up against. So Trump, I first thought it was a joke. I thought that it was just a political ploy, you know, that it was, ego fulfillment. And then I realized, wait a minute, he's in it for real. When I saw the enemy forces that were, lining up against him, I said, they're seeing him as a threat. Even though he brings, you know, his personal, you know, baggage, you know, Trump has, not only is he brash and bold, which in some ways I like that, but he does, he tends to blunder, you know, and so I, many times throughout this campaign, I had highs and I had very, very low lows, because I said, yes, you have the established media, you have the political forces of both parties, you have the world elite, you know, against you. And then you go and trip yourself up. So there were so many, you know, personal, professional and political gaffes. There were so many mismanaged moments, and it was all self-induced. So I said to myself, he just can't get out of the way of himself, you know, the bull in the china closet. And it's great to break glass at times, you know, it's okay. I don't mind that. But, you know, he almost undermined his own campaign. And I really thought he had, as much as I have so much disdain for Kellyanne Conway these days, she was essential during the campaign, because she knew with her polling company, and she knew where to get him the audiences that were required to potentially win those electoral states and break that blue wall. So I give her a lot of credit, you know, during the election season, you know, and I think that if he hadn't had her, he may not have won. But now she's
without
a liability.
Without a doubt, yeah.
I mean, she's just, I mean, now she's acting like Trump in many ways. Like, her personal behavior is just unconscionable, you know. And I mean, the things, I mean, she just shooting from the hip the way she does. I thought she was much more polished and professional, and she was to some extent during the campaign, but in the governing phase, she's terrible.
Now, Tom, what part do you think the alternative media played in this presidential election? Because in elections past, we were always on the sidelines, you know, talking, but nobody was mm-hmm. listening mm-hmm. as far as mainstream taking a notice. I think in this presidential election cycle, the alternative media was finally heard, because now we notice the established media had taken notice of us. So what part do you think alternative media played this go around?
Well, it played a pivotal role. And when I say alternative media, we're not talking about alt-right, although there was alt-right that were involved, but alt-left was involved with helping hellish Hillary. I think that was very interesting. I've never been a fan of Alex Jones personally or professionally. You know, some of the content is true. Some of it, you know, is basically, you know, he learned it from myself and others that were doing this prior to him. But I always prided myself on truthfulness, and I always prided myself on, if I didn't believe that there was enough evidence to substantiate my claims, I wouldn't say it. Or I'd say it in ways that I say I'm hypothesizing or I'm theorizing. But this guy is as fast and loose with the facts. And in many ways, he has helped, I would say, to discredit many of our theories and many of our claims and many of our truths. And so there's a mixed bag there. I think the telling tale was that I never said that he worked for the other side. I always said that he was an opportunist. I always said that, you know, he was a maniac in many ways, because I know how he's treated people over the years, you know, personally and professionally. And these are documented cases. But I never knew for sure what his motivation was beyond making money and ego fulfillment and maybe to some extent the movement. So I was always dubious. But there's others that claimed without facts that he had sold out and that he was working for the other side. And I said, well, I don't have enough evidence of that. You know, I said that I'm suspicious, I'm dubious, but I don't know. But when he went full throttle, not knowing if he would get a backlash from the alternative media, because I thought the alternative media was going to say, oh, Trump is just a player and he's part of, you know, it's being orchestrated and we're being fooled. He went all in for Trump. So he played a huge role. The biggest role, not only for 2016, but 2012, and getting him primed for this was Michael Savage. And yes, you say, well, Savage is on 300 radio stations and he's more mainstream. That's okay. Savage didn't know if this would work out well for him and his career, but he always befriended and always promoted Trump, no matter what. He almost was a candidate. And then he decided to extend his contract and continue working for his, his Trump organization. But more importantly, well, I don't know about more importantly, but probably equally important to him, because of, he is a narcissist and he is an egotist. So he wanted to continue on with The Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice. So he decided, he declined to run for office. And then he was just so disgusted with the Romney campaign and how that election was completely squandered, that he started talking privately to Roger Stone and others and saying, I may run for real. I would say over those next couple of years, you had Michael Savage, you know, always kind of coaxing him and having him on the program and talking to him about a possible run. And then he eventually did commit and joined the race. So I think that he played a huge role that was, yes, part mainstream, part alternative conservative movement. InfoWars and Jones played a role. And another person that I have not been a fan of over the years, but and again, he is repetitive and he's robotic, and you know, I thought he was just a busboy for the GOP, and like Rush was the maitre d'. And I found out that he took a tremendous amount of heat, and that's Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity.
He was the surprise.
He
sure.
played a major role because he had television mm-hmm. and radio. And the attacks kept coming and coming, and Trump would continue to trip himself up. And then it was one report after another report. And it really looked at some point whether it was grabbing the kitty cat of women, you know, everything everyone knows, you know, the Billy Bush tape. And I'm going to get into that for a second, too. Not necessarily the content of it, but you know, who Billy Bush is. And it was just, it was like, I thought at one point the baton was just going to be handed over to Mike Pence. And he's a good guy. He's a radio guy, you know, conservative guy. But he wouldn't be doing all the bold and the work that Trump's, I mean, I've never seen, and even Michael Reagan, the adopted son of Ronald Reagan, said he's never seen a president, that includes his father, that's worked this hard and gotten this much done so quickly at such a frenetic pace. He said that he's a promise keeper. Who would have thought that a president would actually want to keep his promises? So yes, there were, and Mike Gallagher was another one. I was never a big fan of Mike Gallagher. I thought he was kind of an overrated Salem host. I'll tell you what, this guy, I mean, all these guys took the Trump campaign on their back. They took the hits, and nobody knew if this guy was going to be prevail and become the GOP nominee. Many didn't think he'd make it through the summer with all the controversies, and they never wavered. They stuck with him. So talk radio, whether it be the alternative or even some classic traditional conservatives, got behind it and said, and they actually went against some of their stances. See, I've always been a fair trade populist protectionist. You know, I've never believed in this nonsense of even the libertarians believe in open borders, and I always believed in border wall and security and sovereignty of the nation and preserving its culture, etc. And so you have these people that became almost overnight, they started to embrace this protectionist populist point of view, America First point of view, where these are the ones that were promoting and protecting the neocons and war games and those that were free traders and the basically FU to the rest of the American citizenry, in particular, you know, the working class and the manufacturing belts of this country. So it was really, I was shocked. I mean, I really was taken back. And when I came back into talk radio, we can talk about that too. I came up with the title of Free Thinker Radio because I wanted people to think. At that time, in 2009, 10, 11, everybody was just like, it's conservative, it's liberal. You know, it's black, it's white. You know, there's no gray area. There was no independent thought. You know, it was like, you know, one side versus the other. And then you had like the alternative radio, alternative media, that was, it was fractured. It was not really surfacing in mainstream. And it wasn't really that effective. And so this has just changed the whole dynamic. Everything is wide open now. I really believe that this country was on life support. I really believe that by electing Trump, it gave life extension. I mean, I was ready, and I think most people would have believed that America was ready for a burial. You know, the obituary was written if Hillary Clinton had become president.
Right. Now, Tom, speaking of life extension, now, what do you think is going to be in the future in 4 years? Do you think Trump's going to only be a four-year guy, or do you think he could win the second term?
Things are so volatile right now. You know, the New World Order, if you notice, Trump hasn't done anything, he hasn't said much about the Federal Reserve. You know, he's put in some guys that, you know, have ties to the neocons, that have ties to the banking Wall Street order. But I think he realizes that he's giving the orders. Even though sometimes they'll say in a conference setting, or, you know, they'll say things that are a little bit different than President Trump. But I think that if he started to see them try to take him down a path he didn't want to go, he would fire them. And so I'm not too concerned, but, you know, I'm hoping that as time goes on, he gets settled, and if he ever does, that he can take on the Federal Reserve System, maybe bring in Ron Paul and some others that could help him with that particular issue that he's been mostly silent on, except for policy of the Fed. But maybe, you know, and I know that he's good friends with Roger Stone, and they assure their audiences when they appear that Trump knows all these things. You know, he knows all about the conspiracy, knows all about the Federal Reserve, knows all about the true insiders, the elitists that run this world order. And so he's disrupted this world order. I don't know what they plan to do about it. My understanding is he has his private security as well as Secret Service. He knows that his life is in danger. He knows that some of these bold strokes and initiatives are not sitting too well with the established order. And back to the Bush thing, it was interesting that George Bush went off painting, just living a quiet life, doing some things behind the scenes, but would never, not once in 8 years, did he ever criticize Obama. He's already, even if he's doing it kind of in his nice folksy way, criticizing Trump. I think this book that came out is more of a rouge than anything so that he can start speaking out against Trump. And he's done it almost everywhere he's gone. Remember, they're still hurting because of what happened to Jeb Bush. And again, I like the fact he's worked with Wounded Warriors and all that. If George Bush and Dick Cheney hadn't sent them in to some of these senseless conflicts, they wouldn't have been maimed and they wouldn't have died. So if we had not had a neocon militaristic order in the White House run by Dick Cheney, we wouldn't have, many of those soldiers would not have lost their limbs and many that lost their lives. I blame them. And I think that there'll be a nice fiery pit for George, both Bushes that were president, and Dick Cheney. And if someone disagrees, that's fine. It's, you know, at least now I can say it's a somewhat free country. We were leading down the path that it was not going to be a free country. You know, it was scary. And, you know, it really was alarming. We could have another Clinton. I mean, they wanted a Bush and a Clinton to battle it out. And they would win no matter who won. And so they didn't win this time. Even Reagan, they were afraid of Reagan. And I was told by, at that time, he was the president of the Arizona Breakfast Club that knew Ronald Reagan very well. Ronald Reagan confided in him and said that George Herbert Walker Bush was forced onto him. And so he had to take him in order for him. They said he'd be smeared worse than Barry Goldwater if he hadn't taken George Bush to be his vice president. And what did Ollie North say during Iran-Contra, when he said, well, who'd you report to in the White House? He said, you know, in the basement offices, I reported to George Bush, vice president. So George Bush was running a lot of these CIA covert secret operations. And at that time, Reagan was, you know, he was shot after saying some things about the IRS and the Federal Reserve that seemed to be somewhat suspicious, especially when the Bush family had a relationship with the Hinckley family. So in Denver, which a lot of people don't really know. So you have this Billy Bush tape comes out. Well, Billy Bush is part of the Bush political dynasty, the crime syndicate, the clan of the Bush family. My feeling is, and again, I don't know for sure, but I'm speculating, but I think that I'm on the right path here, and that is that Billy Bush was told by Jeb and others in the Bush clan, give us that tape, and we're going to sit on that tape. And yeah, it's going to hurt your career. But we got plenty of money for you, so you don't worry about it. But you got to take this one for the team. That tape was known for quite some time, and then boom, it's released. They thought that was the final blow, that this would knock out all the conservatives and all the evangelicals that weren't real comfortable with the personal behavior and the erratic nature and the baggage of Trump. But they said, you know what? The policies are in alignment for the most part with what we want. And we're going to support him. Just like Jerry Falwell Jr. said, he said, we're not electing a pastor-in-chief. We're electing a commander-in-chief. So we're not expecting that kind of perfection. They thought that was it, that it was over. Matter of fact, there's been some reporting, and I think there's some credibility to this, that Trump at one point said to Mike Pence, I think I'm going to have to give this over to you. And they said, well, that's not the way it works. You're not able to do it that way. But they could have worked it through some kind of reconvening and some kind of voting, and they could have given it to Pence. But it couldn't have been just like, you couldn't just walk out and say, Mike Pence is now your candidate. It would have had to go back to the, the GOP and the RNC to work that out. But it was close. And the thing that bothers me about Trump, he never wants to admit he's wrong. You know, I like someone that can be humble. You know, you can be bold, but there's a humble side, and you can come out and say, I could have handled that differently, or I misspoke, or I made a mistake, or make amends. He doesn't do that. And then he likes to have these little feuds with Arnold Schwarzenegger and some plump beauty queen and some has-been from Hollywood. And, you know, these things are just ridiculous. It's nonsensical. It's I don't know if he's going to continue to mature. I mean, he gave a great speech, a tremendous speech. You know, reporting to the nation, even though it's not technically the State of the Union because he hadn't been in office a full year, but it's similar to the State of the Union. All I can say is that the good Lord has used all kinds of men and women throughout, you know, biblical times and even in modern times that you would not think could be the hero, that could be the savior, if you will. And I don't take that word lightly, but really, he is becoming the hero and the savior of this country, politically speaking. That Donald Trump would be, you know, the elected. I mean, and again, also, who cares about the popular vote? It means nothing. The rules, it'd be like, you know, trying to change the rules in a basketball game and say, well, we hit more 3-point shots. Yeah, but the total points that counted, you lost. I would have just, if I was Trump, I would have said, if it ever changes, or if it had been the popular vote, I would have spent more time in all the population centers and gathered up and garnered more votes and spent more advertising dollars and did more rallies. That's not that he played by the rules and he won by a super wide margin. I mean, 30 states to 20.
Yeah. You know, we're about out of time. And before we go, could you tell us what you might be doing in the near future as far as, you know, your writing or broadcasting? And also before we go, I'd like you to give your website address out so that people can check out your work online.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you've allowed this to be a long form interview, that you've given me a lot of latitude. But I like being drawn out. Like I was on with the Earth Radio Live guys from a former hometown of mine in Jacksonville, Florida, and they're also online. And a particular interview is available through my podcast directory and through my website, and I'll give that out in a second. It's really difficult for me, being a former syndicated broadcaster. And I wasn't just like on some alternative station. I wasn't just buying time. I was on 150 to 200 radio stations in my peak. And then go from that to you go online. You're trying to look, find out how many people are on the stream, how many people may have downloaded a podcast. And then you go, it's really, you know, I'm not having that kind of major impact or success. And I don't feel like I have to carry the weight of the world on my shoulders, which back in the 90s, when there's so few of us that were doing this, all you had was, you know, talk radio. You had magazines, which, you know, it took forever to get published, and audio tapes. Maybe a videotape of a conference that took place, but it wasn't any kind of immediate impact unless you were there at the conference. And then you had International Shortwave, which I was also on. So if some people were saying, I think he sounds familiar. Well, I also was involved not only with broadcast during the day, it rebroadcast, and sometimes I would even do a monologue to introduce an interviewer segment on International Shortwave, that was a WWCR. So my show would come on, then Bill Cooper, and then Tom Valentine. So it was kind of the trifecta, and that's where the alternative media really got going, was on International Shortwave Radio. But I was the one penetrated, established talk radio, because there was nobody else was on that many stations that were talking about this on a daily basis. You know, one of the most profound experiences I had was having Bo Greitz on my program day in and day out, and the late, great Jack McLam, reporting from Ruby Ridge, Idaho. And so I had some backlash, and because they said, well, can't you talk about something else? I said, until this is resolved, no, I cannot. You know, the majority of my programming will be focused on the resolution and what we can salvage for that family and have some kind of justice at Ruby Ridge. And then later I move back to Dallas and I'm drawn into the whole Waco fiasco and covering that day and night. It was, they were two very pivotal and very horrific, but also, life altering experiences to be part of those things and be part of, sadly, those tragedies in American history. My website is TomDonahueReports.com. TomDonahueReports.com. And I'm on Podomatic. I'm on Stitcher. I'm on TuneIn. Program director at TalkStream Live. So you'll see a lot of good programming. And I always try to look for interesting alternative programming to add to the directory. It's one of the largest streaming dynamic talk radio directories in the world.
Well, Tom, listen, thank you so much for giving me the interview today. And we got to have you back on because there's so many other things that we've got to talk about. So, listeners, today my guest has been Tom Donahue. He was the pioneer radio talk show host in alternative media, and he's currently program director for TalkStream Live, We've been discussing a little bit about his background, and we hope to hear again from you soon, Tom. Again,
well,
thanks
Angeline,
so
thank
much.
You for the invite. Thanks for the good interview. And I'm going to close out with one of my trademark mottos, putting America first, new world order dead last, patriotism in action.
Good. Listeners, until next week, God bless.
Also, don't forget, you can always learn more about our program and find podcasts posted at truthseekersradioshow.com.